Pee spray drizzles down my neck, mixing with my sweat. I roll forward and pull the two mess buckets behind the block. Cooper has also let go of his mess bucket and is hauling it to safety. He is lying a couple of paces further forward, next to a protective wall. I want to catch him up, and I take a pace forward, only to fall into emptiness. Hands grab me and pull me up.
"Hang on," says a deep voice.
And then,
"Where did you come from so suddenly? We were just about to fire on you. You were bloody lucky."
Domscheit tells them,
"Christ, do you have to use this particular street? We've got Ivan sitting right on our backs here."
"I came by here just 2 hours ago, and Ivan was further forward," Domscheit says.
"Yes, but in the last hour, not so. Max, do you have your sprayer ready?"
asks the low voice.
"Of course, as always," comes the answer.
"Good. Then we'll give you covering fire. You can get through behind us, across the street. Now, off with you."
On their first burst of fire, we dash off. Cooper is faster than me and nearly pulls my arm out of its socket because I'm still holding on to the other handle of the food container. Ivan shoots wildly back. Then the artillery opens up. In between, I can also hear the thud of the mortars. The rounds loop towards us and explode all around. The bombardment seems to go for us like a wild animal, and we squeeze together in a bombed-out basement. I duck further down with each explosion, expecting the basement to collapse any moment and bury the lot of us. The earth above shakes, just like in an earthquake, I should think. My nerves are aflutter. I'd never imagined I could be so terrified. You can't do anything. Not a thing. The only solution might actually be to get out and run. But where? The only advantage is that death will come more quickly. For heaven's sake, they are forever going on about the proud, successful German advances in the army news bulletins. But here in Stalingrad, I haven't seen anything of that. The only thing I understand is that we are holed up in these ruins like cowering rats, fighting for our lives. But what else can we do, given the Russian superiority? The driver and the medic are sitting next to me, with Winter and Cooper on the other side. Cooper is as white as a sheet, and we are all staring at the ceiling, which already has a huge number of cracks. Domscheit has the strongest nerves. He is standing by the entrance, staring out into the darkness. As far as Cooper and I are concerned, these few hours in Stalingrad have certainly dampened down our enthusiasm for war, and we haven't yet had any personal contact, as it is so nicely put. My thoughts now are concentrated solely on how and when we're going to be able to get out of here safely. We've been in this god-awful heap of ruins for hours, and we still haven't reached our unit. Domscheit tells us from his position at the entrance that Ivan is shooting at the slightest thing. Because our machine guns opened up, Ivan probably thought we were mounting another attack and wanted to make quite sure that it was nipped in the bud.
"If only he knew that we are quite happy keeping our heads down for the moment, until we get our replacements, that is," says Domscheit. "We're supposed to be replaced by fresh troops, according to our Wachtmeister."
"He who believes is indeed blessed," murmurs the medic. Finally, the barrage is lifted, after what seems to me like an eternity. We jump up. Domscheit knows the way. He makes for a ruined factory building, knowing that someone has been lying there undercover, watching everything. Softly, he calls out the code word while we are still some distance away, and gives his name. We go to a basement entrance, which is half covered by wreckage. Domscheit leads us through a corridor to a room, where in front of the doorway an iron plate has been placed. I can see two Hindenburg lanterns, which provide just enough light to clear the darkness in the room. Domscheit makes a droll introduction.
"May I present our new battle headquarters?"
A heap of sacks and a few rags are strewn on the ground, and lying on top of them, curled up, are two Lancer. Another one is sitting on a couple of stacked-up ammunition boxes. Startled by the noise we have made, the two Lancer jump up and help us into the room with our containers. Both men appear to be very tired, and who knows when they might next get some sleep. I can barely distinguish their faces under all the dirt and stubble, but I guess we all look about the same. Then a Wachtmeister comes in. He says hello and offers his hand to Weichert. I recognize him. He's the one who pushed the old Russian fellow's head into the bucket at the well. He tells Winter that the one remaining officer in the group became a casualty this morning, and that now he was in charge of this sector. The men are positioned in front and to the side of this area, hidden in the ruins. The fighting ebbs back and forth, and no one really knows where the Hauptkampflinie really runs. Casualties today are one dead and two wounded, and they're already on the way to the main medical center.
This is the craziest place imaginable. The Russians are often only 20 or 30 meters away, sometimes at hand grenade range in front of us. No more than 200 meters in front of us there is a deep trench, and this trench leads right down to the banks of the Volga. From there, Ivan gets reinforcements every night.
For days now, we've all been waiting impatiently to be relieved, or at least to receive reinforcements, but we're beginning to doubt whether they'll ever come. This last sentence is only whispered to Winter, but with my sharp ears I still understand what he has said. So, they've got their doubts. That makes me think. The warm food and the coffee must by now be frozen solid, even though the containers have double skins and are supposed to be insulated. Winter has brought a fair supply of solid methylated spirits along, and a solid fuel burner to heat up the food. The food is ice cold, but not frozen solid. It's a good, thick noodle soup with lots of canned beef, much better than what we get in the bunkers. These men have more than earned these decent rations. Winter is pressing for us to start getting back. An hour has passed since we left our bunker. The Wachtmeister needs more ammunition, which we've got on the trucks. He details 5 men to go with us. On the way there, the Russians lob more heavy shells into the area. We run after the lead soldier at the double and stop only briefly each time a large shell lands nearby. We jump up on the trucks and sit on the empty ammunition boxes. The dead soldier we are taking back with us lies in the front, in his body bag. There is supposed to be another road we can take going back. The driver says that the route across the village of Petschanka and past another kolkhoz to Vavarovka is shorter going from here. Because of the frost, all the roads are quite passable. But first, we have to work our way through the ruins. Every now and then, the vehicles drive down into a trench and come up the other side, and we're catapulted towards the back and have to hang on to the tailgate, the ammo boxes sliding after us and slamming into our jackboots.
Just keep going, I think. Just get out of here.
When it all starts up again, we need to be well out of range. We go through another deep trench and have to help push the truck back out again. We pass several other vehicles, and some VW jeeps with officers as passengers pass us. The MSR is rough, but hard and solid. How far is it now? I ask the medic, who is looking back at us from up front through a slip in the tarpaulin.
Just a few kilometers, I hear him saying.
At that moment we all hear a thundering noise, as though the world were going to split apart at any moment. I slide hastily towards the back and release part of the tarpaulin. I see a frightful spectacle, one that makes me cringe. Cooper joins me and stares open-mouthed. It would be a beautiful sight were it not for the sinister roaring and the continuous explosions, which make you realize that thousands of lives are being sacrificed. The sky is glowing over Stalingrad. Greyish-white smoke billows from the ground. Flames shoot high into the sky in between. The long probing fingers of the searchlights tear at the half-darkness of the breaking day. There must be a lot of aircraft up. Bombs are ceaselessly raining down on a city that has been condemned to death. The explosions merge into one another, creating a devastating inferno. Tracer patterns from the anti-aircraft guns climb high into the sky for kilometers around. 2 aircraft explode over the hellish fires and are swallowed up by them.
This is absolutely crazy. No one can survive this. And yet, even in this inferno, some are managing to stay alive. Not only that, they are defending themselves and fighting back.
The proof is that after every bombardment, the enemy counterattacks once more, and sometimes even gains a bit of ground, although usually he is stopped in his tracks and pushed back to where he started from. This is the way it has been since the beginning of September, ever since German troops forced their way into the city. But because of the strong defences along the Volga, the Germans have now been obliged to hide in the ruins. When we return to the bunkers, it is full daylight. We can hear only a far-off droning noise, just as before. But for me, it is no longer the same. I now see the disaster that will come out of this hapless city. It is a stark warning to everyone languishing in the rear areas, wasting their time by making their quarters comfortable for the winter. Chapter 3. A Narrow Escape. Today is the 17th of November, 1942. Yesterday we had the first snowfall, and a white blanket now covers the steppe as far as the eye can see. It seems as if everything around is muffled. Even the rumble of battle is barely audible when the wind carries the sound over to us. Last night a few soldiers came back from Stalingrad. I'm glad to see that the sickly Stabsgefreiter Petsch is among them. It's obvious that he wasn't much use at the front, owing to his nervous condition. The unit has suffered a lot more casualties. These include Unteroffizier Seifert, who has been badly wounded and has a splinter in his leg. Domscheit apparently was extremely lucky, according to another soldier. A bomb took his helmet off, and the only injury he suffered was a cut from his chin strap. A fellow standing no more than 2 meters away was blown into the air. The only things left of him were individual body parts, which they gathered up in a ground sheet. In the evening we have a chat with Meinhardt about the general situation as far as it has affected us. It is more a mishmash of rumours, assumptions and hopes that things will turn out in our favour. He's been drinking again, I can smell it on his breath, and he is therefore much more communicative. Varias is rubbing his back against a beam, and the noise he makes is so loud that we turn to look at him. We've all used lice powder, and we've even boiled our underwear, but it only helps for a while. Zeidel inadvertently crashes into the back of another soldier, who sprawls headlong onto the floor. Zeidel helps him to his feet and mutters some excuse or other. We haven't seen the soldier with the chevron before. But before anyone can say anything else, Meinhardt bellows,
"Hey, Svina, where on earth have you come from? I thought you were at the front with the others."
He in turn clutches his throat and croaks something unintelligible. He is short and quite chubby. He's got a scarf round his neck and a cap on his head, which he has pulled down so far that it almost covers his somewhat dangly ears. He goes over to Meinhardt at the table, and our eyes follow him in curiosity. When he takes his cap off, I get the feeling that everyone is kind of smirking. Even I can hardly hold it back. The name Svina brings to mind the image of a grunting creature whose meat we haven't had for a while, especially with his chubby pink cheeks and little red eyes, which look at us from beneath bristling white eyebrows. He has a rounded, good-natured, almost comical face, with a mop of straw-coloured hair on top. Svina offers Meinhardt his hand. He motions to his scarf and grunts,
"Got a bad throat. Can barely speak. Wachtmeister Homikat sent me to the rear to recover."
"That was very sensible of him. How long have you been here?" asks Meinhardt.
"What?"
grunts Svina, stretching his head forward like a bird. Meinhardt pulls Svina towards him and speaks directly into his ear.
"How long have you been here?"
"For an hour. We're supposed to come here to the 4th Schwadron, but the truck crashed. Had to wait all day before we could get a tow."
"Did anyone else come with you?"
Meinhardt speaks right into Svina's ear.
"Yes. Gorny and Kirstein."
"What, they're both here?"
exclaims Meinhardt in delight. The chubby Gefreiter nods, but he looks dejected and barely audibly explains,
"Gorny only lost a bit of his arm, but Kirstein was killed outright. A shell splinter. They brought him to the cemetery straight away."
Meinhardt must have known the dead soldier very well. He says in a thick voice,
"Bloody Stalingrad. Soon there won't be any of the old fellows left. Now Fritz has gone, and he always believed that nothing could ever happen to him. We were together for a month. Once his rifle was shot out of his hand, and shortly after that, a splinter tore open the side of his helmet. But he was quite convinced that no Russian bullet would ever have his name on it. He would die in his bed, an old man. Nothing would persuade him otherwise, despite the fact that many of our friends were falling around us. And now it has happened, old chum, even though you never thought it could."
Meinhardt mutters to himself. He starts sucking on his pipe and blowing out clouds of smoke. Zvina sits on the bench, staring into the flickering light of the improvised petrol lamp which was put in our bunker yesterday. Some clever individual takes wine bottles half full of petrol and sticks a cartridge case with two holes in the side up through the cork. The gas which escapes through the cartridge case is ignited and burns evenly, lighting up the bunker better than the usual Hindenburg candles, which are in short supply anyway. It's all a bit depressing here in the bunker right now. The faces around me no longer look carefree and unconcerned. We've heard about the heavy casualties, and also about the problems that exist resupplying the troops, particularly over the last few days. The Russians, in the meantime, are reported to have increased their strength considerably along the Volga.
"What does it look like at the front?" we hear Meinhardt asking Zvina.
Zvina doesn't understand the question and cups his hand to his ear. The man must be almost deaf, and realizing this, everybody glances at everyone else. Meinhardt speaks more loudly, directly into Zvina's ear.
"What's it look like up at the front?"
"Worse and worse," Zvina croaks. "2 days ago, 2 mortars in our sector were lost. We've only got one now in our battle group."
"Spies has told me that already," says Meinhardt.
Then he bends forward and says in a loud voice,
"Hey, it gets worse with you all the time. Last time we were together, at least you could hear better."
Zvina points to his throat.
"It's because of my throat."
What does his throat have to do with deafness, we wonder. Meinhardt is thinking exactly the same thing. More to us than to Zvina, he says,
"What do you mean, your throat?
They should be packing you off home when you are this deaf. I don't understand why they're always sending you back up to the front lines. By the way, which bunker are you in?"
"The first one, with the young submachine gun blokes," croaks Zvina. "But I don't like it there."
We look at each other, and Meinhardt smiles.
"These fellows spray everything," he says, "but they don't like it when you tell them that."
The chubby Zvina shifts uneasily. Scratching himself and shrugging his shoulders, he croaks,
"That's what everyone tells the new boys."
We all laugh.
"Do you want to come into our bunker?"
Meinhardt again has his mouth close to Zvina's ear, and at the same time is looking at us. We nod. Why not? It's big enough. If we pull our stuff a bit closer together, we can get another 2 in. Zvina says yes to the question and looks up at us.
"Okay, go get your stuff. You can stay here," says Meinhardt out loud.
The chubby little Gefreiter grins and trots like a walking flower bag out of the bunker. If it were not so tragic, this whole incident would have been comical. Meinhardt says he cannot understand how Zvina could have got into the army in the first place. In the summer, he tells us, Zvina came to the Schwadron with a group of returning convalescents. He couldn't hear very well even then. At first, people thought that he was being antisocial because he never answered anyone's questions, but then it was realized that he couldn't even hear the shells screaming overhead and had to be pulled to safety at the last moment. His deafness became even worse after a shell exploded right next to him, so he can't do very much. Most of the time he's been bringing up ammunition stocks and fetching rations, and for these tasks he has been absolutely dependable. He seems to get a little bit anxious when he is at the front, but this is only because of his hearing difficulties. Zvina is certainly not a coward. Meinhardt puffs away at his pipe. He only actually lets it go out when he's asleep. He fumbles around under the table, pulls out a half-empty bottle, and takes a long swig. In the dark, I hadn't even noticed it was there.
"Why'd you call him Zvina?" Grommel wants to know.
"Very simple.
That's his name," laughs Meinhardt.
"What? I thought it was a nickname," Varias retorts, surprised. "Well, it's not his full name. We've shortened it, actually. His full name is Johann Svinovsky."
So, that's the way it is. Outside, someone is kicking up a racket at the entrance, and then Zvina comes waddling back in. He is carrying his kit bag, and he's got some blankets under his arm. Zeidel shows him to the spot beside Meinhardt, which he has cleared for him. The night passes quietly. Once in a while I wake up as I subconsciously hear a new noise in the bunker, which turns out to be a satisfied grunt. 18th of November. The night is cold and frosty. I have dressed for warmth for my guard duty, with a scarf round my neck. The frost bites at my ears. With each step, the frozen snow crunches under my boots. I think about home and about going skiing in the glistening winter sun with its crunchy snow. I was a good skier and could often make around 30 meters at our ski jump. Here in the steppe, everything is flat, as it is on our lake. In order to reach our ski jump, we would have to cross the frozen lake on skis for about 3 kilometers. By that time, we would have worked up a pretty good sweat.
Those were wonderful times.
As I do on so many clear nights, I am staring up into the night sky. I'm searching for the little bear and tracing up to the pole star to find north. I have at least a general idea of the direction where home is. I can often hear, even late at night, Unteroffizier Döring on his harmonica, playing his favourite tune, Home, Your Stars. Tonight, Döring is the duty NCO, and is making his rounds of the bunker area. He also leads our combat training. He is a real old-timer, released from his service at the front to give us training. We have no problem with him, and have learned a lot from him. Not exercises, but first-hand experience in trench training. 19th of November. Towards morning the wind picks up. The weather is hazy, and light snow clouds are moving over the steppe. Meinhardt tells us that he has to return to Stalingrad today. The Spieß told him so yesterday. He'll drive over with Winter. It is also his turn to go.
Oh well, says Meinhardt reflectively. That's life.
True, says Kurat, but it could take 100 years.
Could be, agrees Meinhardt. But I don't want to grow that old. I shall be quite happy if I can survive this bloody war.
You will, says Grommel with conviction. We all want to give him a bit of courage, but we probably fail, as Meinhardt doesn't talk much after this. He is smoking even more than usual. Then he sits down and writes a letter home. The next drill is after lunch, so until then we get busy cleaning our weapons and getting all our equipment in order. As we report to our formation, something is different in our bunker area. Drivers are running backwards and forwards and are busy with their vehicles. A courier scurries around on his motorcycle and disappears in the direction of the kolkhoz. We also have to wait longer than usual for the Spieß to show up. Something is happening. But what? We look at each other. Our neighbours from the next bunker don't know anything either. Then the Spieß arrives with maps in his hands. He tells us, not beating about the bush, that we are now at the highest state of alert because the Russians have attacked the left flank of the front with strong tank units and broken through the Romanian lines around Kletskaya. The entire Romanian front has reportedly caved in, with the remnants fleeing in the direction of Kalach. Shit, I hear one of our instructors exclaim. The Spieß waters down our first shock by telling us that steps have already been taken to start pushing the Russians back. Our tanks and air force have already engaged them. More we are not told. Meinhardt tells us later that he and Winter will not be sent back into Stalingrad because no one knows where our combat group is at the moment. They were pulled out of the ruins and reassigned somewhere else. We have to wait. He also tells us that the Schirmeister reckons that the vehicles will be able to get going, but he doesn't have enough fuel for all of them because for the last few weeks there has been a big shortage of petrol and other supplies.
Is it really that bad? Asks Meinhardt.
The Schirmeister shrugs his shoulders.
No one knows anything for sure, but it could be that we'll have to move our vehicles out of here if we can't stop the Russians.
In that case, sod it, says Seidel in his flippant style. We sleep uneasily. When I begin my guard duty at about 0500, I listen intently for any noise coming from the north in the dark. The wind brings muffled rolling noises to my ear, but no more than usual. If fighting is taking place near Kletskaya, we wouldn't be able to hear anything anyway because it's too far away. Or could it be that the breakthrough has been stopped by our own troops? 20th of November. As daytime emerges, things get busy. We've never seen so many HE-111 bombers and JU-87 Stukas. In other words, something serious must be going on up north. The skies are filled with the roar of engines, and we can also hear a faraway rumbling noise. It increases hour by hour, becoming more distinct and swelling to a rolling thunder. It's coming from the north, where the Russians are supposed to have broken through. But soon we are also hearing it from the south as well. Something is happening down there. We are on full alert and are waiting. Some men are in their bunkers, others, like me, standing on the top of the bunker, waiting for whatever it is coming towards us.
"Alarm!" someone is yelling. "Everybody out of the bunkers!"
We dash down into the bunkers, pick up our weapons and all our equipment, and struggle into it while we run back up again. Many have to go back down in the bunkers to pick up their winter coats. What's going on? You can read the questions in our faces. Then one of the drivers says that the Russians have also broken through the Romanian lines in the south and are coming at us from both sides, trying to take us in a pincer movement. Their tanks have already reached Seti, and we are supposed to hold them back. I suspect that things will now become serious for us and for everybody else around Stalingrad. We felt secure for the winter in our shelters and bunkers, but the rumbling has grown steadily right through into the night. Anybody who doubted what was happening now knows better. Even the most inexperienced soldier here realizes that we are about to be taken in a pincer movement. It's still quiet at the moment, but for how long? Is it the lull before the storm? 21st of November. And so it proves. It begins in the early morning with the whining of heavy shells over our heads and their crackling explosions. Anybody still in his bunker runs out into his prepared position, but we see nothing.
"Their artillery are just firing to get the range," says the driver sitting beside me. "Most of the rounds are landing to our right and further to the rear. Stalinorgel rockets zoom overhead, landing near the kolkhoz." Slowly it gets lighter, and we can see a little better. In amongst the howling and the explosions, we can now hear other noises, the droning of diesel engines and the squeaky clatter of tank tracks. Russian T-34s are circling round. They can see the situation better. Their shots ring out, making a harsh metallic sound in the frosty air. The shells cut through the air with a swish and explode on their targets. Often the shells hit the ground as hot glowing balls, only to ricochet with a swish high into the air and then boring back into the ground.
"Tank shells!" yells someone.
Then the T-34s emerge from the haze. I count five of the steel giants. They are still some 100 meters away and moving only slowly. Their guns swivel, searching for targets. When they have found them, they fire. The artillery barrage is also increasing. Again, their targets seem to be to our side and behind us. The tanks are also firing there. Haven't they seen us yet, or do they have a better target over there? Someone is creeping up behind us in the trench. It's Jansen, the truck driver. He is followed by two Russian volunteers bringing up ammunition. Jansen works his way over to Meinhardt at the machine gun. I can hear what he's saying. Fuel has been provided, and orders have been given to move all the trains out, with all the vehicles, over the bridge at Kalach towards the west. The Spies and Döring want to wait until nightfall, because we've got no anti-tank support. Otherwise, the Russian tanks could knock us over like ninepins. Then, over our heads, we hear the deep droning noise of Russian combat aircraft. They drop their bombs, and smoke billows up behind us. From the side, three small aircraft are diving down towards us. We can easily identify the Soviet star on the fuselages and wings. We stare towards the front. My nerves are fluttering. Everything is different compared to all the combat training. Various thoughts flash through my head. The tanks in front of us are moving very slowly. I sneak over to Meinhardt and peer through his field glasses. The soldiers look like dirty brown lumps of clay glued onto the white camouflaged tanks, as for the first time I see our enemies in front of me. A faint shudder goes through my body. If they get me, everything is over, because we have often heard in gruesome detail what they do to German soldiers. There is a mixture of excitement, fright, and rebelliousness about what could be happening to us. My mouth is dry, and I grip my carbine more tightly. Meinhardt, who has carefully lifted his white chalked helmet over the edge of his trench, seems to think that they are moving towards the right, past us. They are at the receiving end of heavy fire from there. The stream in front of us stops, and the infantry dismount. They would be much too far away for our machine guns and carbines.
Maybe they have not even seen us. Our counterfire slackens, and the tanks and infantry move almost parallel to us, further towards the right. We wait and watch. The enemy tanks go out of sight, and the shooting dies down. The haze in front of us increases and slowly spreads over the white plain. We wait for a while longer, then comes the command, "Everyone to the vehicles, and mount!" We wait until the vehicles are out of their covered positions, and then we climb aboard.
"Go!"
We look round. We're a bit downcast. The bunkers were a sort of shelter for us. We had got used to the straw bedding and the cracked clay walls. Now we are off into the cold, across the hard frozen snow, with its great unknowns. The general direction is Kalach. The driver of the lead vehicle knows the way, and has often driven it. In spite of our winter coats, we are freezing cold in the vehicle, even though on Meinhardt's suggestion I have put on a second shirt and an extra pair of underpants. I am not alone in my misery. Our empty stomachs don't help. The body needs fuel. We received only cold rations this morning, but still haven't had time to eat. We try to eat now, but we abandon the idea of drinking anything, as the coffee in our canteens is frozen solid. On the way we meet up with other traffic, trucks, personnel carriers, motorcycles, jeeps, half-trucks with gun carriages and guns. They are all moving like we are, in great haste to escape something which we sense rather than see. Beside us there are the remains of destroyed or defective vehicles. The Rolban UVD recently dropped his parachute flares and his bombs, and a quad anti-aircraft gun had finally chased him away. We are told about this by a driver who wants to jump up onto our vehicle. Varias unceremoniously hauls him up. There are many others along the road who try to jump up on our vehicles. As we come to a rail line, we take another soldier on board. He says that his supply vehicle was hit not far from here, just about half an hour ago, by a shell from a T-34. His sergeant was killed immediately, and he was wounded in the head, but had escaped on foot. "It's about 10 kilometers to the Don Bridge at Kalach," he says. The vehicles which have converged on the bridge have built up into a huge traffic jam trying to get across. Everyone is pushing, and the traffic is barely creeping along. It would probably be quicker to walk, but then, in the darkness and in confusion, we'd probably be hard put to find our places again. So we stay where we are and freeze. The other vehicles with Döring and the Spieß are out of sight. 22nd of November. In the morning the fog lifts from the Don, and a milky white veil slowly envelops the bridge. We have just made it across when we hear the harsh metallic report of a tank gun. A Russian tank is firing into the vehicles which are making for the bridge ready to cross. We can only see the action as weak shadows. There are explosions. "The 88mm AA gun has been hit," says Cooper, who has been sitting at the back all the way and can see a bit more clearly. The vehicles in front of us give fuel and drive into the mass ahead of us, which is getting ever thicker. We follow. After a few kilometers we stop. Everything is quiet. We get down, walk around a bit to get the circulation back in our limbs, and wait. For what? For the other vehicles? In this fog it would only be sheer luck if we found them again. We are now only three vehicles. The Schiermeister with his Steyr and four men, and two Opel Blitz trucks with 14 men and three soldiers from other units. Our nerves are on edge. We are running beside the vehicles so that our feet don't get frozen. "Stop! Turn the engines off." The Schiermeister orders a halt, gesturing to the other drivers. We can hear the sound of engines quite clearly now. They are pretty rough, and I reckon they are diesels.
"T-34s, whispers the Schiermeister, who knows about these things. "We must go back. We can't get through here," he whispers.
The Russians are already across the Don and are blocking our way. We can also hear tank engines to the right of us. We assume that they are advancing in line. The noises disappear now and then, but they always come back. We start up our engines. They run smoothly, and we drive very slowly back. Two soldiers are leading the way and are waving our vehicles on. It is a nerve-wracking business, and I get the impression that we're going round in circles. At any moment a Russian tank could be standing in front of us, his engine cut, ready to blow us to pieces. But he can't see in the mist any better than we can, and has to rely on what he can hear. That at least is something in our favour, though it's not much. Again, there are noises in front of us. A flare goes up. We keep stock still. Have they seen us? The light from the flare hardly penetrates the fog, giving it a ghostly appearance. The drivers immediately cut their engines. The yellowish light falls and is extinguished in the snow. Silence. My heart is pounding in my throat. Then a diesel starts up with a low droning noise. Tank tracks squeak, and slowly the tank moves and disappears to our left. Wow, that was a bit of luck. But he is in the same situation as we are. It's possible he's heard us, but for him too it must have been scary. Where to now? Have we been driving around in circles? That's always a possibility in these conditions. We carry on driving at walking pace through the milky soup, just like before. Then one of the soldiers, who has been walking ahead of us, comes back, out of breath, to report that he has noticed a weak light from a fire or something to our side. We must assume that the Russians are there, and he suggests a recce. I am in the patrol. We creep very carefully in the direction of the suspect area. We don't see the red glare of the fire until we are quite close. The flames are flickering. In the fog, it looks as if it is burning in a hollow. The thick fog gives the illusion of walls. To right and left, the dark outlines of houses and barns appear. We glide over the snow, closer to the fire, and can make out several figures talking together. Then one of the soldiers beside me gives a start and blurts out happily, "Thank God! They're ours!" I too have recognized them by their language. It is the Spieß with Döring and two personnel carriers. Among the 12 men are Meinhardt, Svina, and the 6 Stabsgefreiter, Petsch. Just like us, they have been fumbling around in the fog, and then ended up here in the Kolkhoz. Where the rest of our vehicles have ended up, they don't know either. The Spieß and some of the others discuss the matter. They agree that an advance party should try to find a gap. The vehicles will then move forward quietly as far as they can, and then make a run for it through the gap at full speed. We pray that the fog won't lift, otherwise it would be our undoing. After the fire has been put out, we slowly follow the advance party. We walk quietly beside the vehicles in order to keep warm. I have to rub my eyes continually. The constant staring into the fog and the cutting cold is affecting my sight. Whenever we watch, we imagine figures in front of us and clutch our weapons that much more tightly. Then Russian voices can clearly be heard coming from the left. Then there is a loud yell and a question. In response, a tank engine starts up with a droning noise. Then the engine of the Steyr screams into life, and Janssen pushes the accelerator pedal of the Opel Blitz to the floor. Our truck leaps forward and then drives on. Then we hear the engines of our other vehicles to the right of us. We can see nothing in front of us. The milky mass is just like a wall. Driving across the bumpy steppe, we are thrown up to the canvas roof over the truck and hold on to the framework of the flatbed for all we are worth. We hope the truck won't break an axle. Behind us we hear the sharp report of the tank gun firing. The rounds swish overhead. The T-34s are shooting blindly into the fog. It would have to be sheer luck if they were to hit us. "We made it!" yells Varias, and all our pent-up excitement is released. Although we have broken through the tank barrier, the question still remains, are we out of the encirclement? The gunfire from behind has stopped, and Janssen eases his foot off the pedal as the engine has run hot. Where are we, and where are the others? We haven't seen anyone lately. The fog hasn't lifted at all. It's just as thick as ever, and we're swimming in the middle of it. We dismount again and walk about to warm our feet up. The snow crunches underfoot, and we are leaving tracks all over the place. Gommel finds tire tracks from 2 vehicles. We follow them, and soon we come across the 2nd Opel Blitz and the Steyr personal carrier. The truck is hanging with a rear wheel over a hole on the rim of a Rachel. We hadn't thought of this problem. We ourselves could easily have ended up in one. We get the truck out of the hole and rest up in the next Rachel. Slowly the fog lifts. Behind us there is nothing but snow-covered steppe. We hear fighting in the distance. What now? No one knows. "We were supposed to drive south to Nizhny Chirskaya," a Nobergefreiter reminds the Schiermeister. That's the village where the rear echelon supply vehicles were supposed to assemble after the Russian breakthrough. Okay, fine. Off to Nizhny Chirskaya. A really disheartening feeling comes over me. I would prefer to just get off the vehicle and disappear, as many have already done. It's not that I am a coward, but the retreat from the Russians, the soldiers around me with their frightened, pale faces, many of them without weapons, all add up to a very uneasy feeling. Then there is the sight of the little Leutnant, who seems to be an administrative official or a teacher, and who, as the only officer, is probably now obliged to take on a job he is not up to. In his buttonhole he wears the red-striped ribbon of the so-called Gefrierfleischorden, which was awarded to more or less everybody who survived the Russian winter campaigns of 1941-42. I assume he has no front-line experience, and everyone else sees it the same way. He divides us into groups and sends us out to secure the MSR using tank positions left over from an earlier combat. What a situation! We have neither heavy weapons nor sufficient small arms or ammunition. The holes are partially filled with snow. I work with Cooper like a wild thing to clean up a tank shelter just to keep warm. I have to give the Leutnant full marks because he has been able to scrounge a hot meal for us. We have no idea what it is much too foggy and dark to tell. But it's made from meat and tastes delicious. In the next hole, Zeidel starts to laugh. He thinks it's the old horse which we saw on the railway line earlier. This could be true, but in any case, this hot meal, the first in 3 days, tastes terrific. 23rd of November. It's quiet this morning, although German bombers and fighters are up and about. A small, wiry infantry Unteroffizier von der Infanterie, who has been assigned as our Gruppenführer, peers through his field glasses at the troops coming towards us. We expect a Russian attack, but as they get nearer, we realize that they are in fact stragglers from our own forces. They join up with us, increasing our strength. Several more vehicles arrive, including a 75mm anti-tank gun, a quad anti-aircraft gun from our regiment, which we can use for ground defense, and an 88mm from an anti-aircraft gun battalion. Many of these men know each other and are pleased to meet up with friends again. We also have a stroke of good luck, because the personnel carrier with Döring and the others reach us. They got lost in the fog and again ran into another tank. They kept their heads down for the entire night, and first thing this morning they drove off, as if the devil was after them. To our delight, our Spieß and two further vehicles, including our field kitchen, also reach us. Our unit is now well represented. From what we are told, some of our supply vehicles were able to make it across to the south side of the Don yesterday, and should even now be on their way to Nizhny Chirskaya. Chapter 4. A Last-Minute Reprieve. During the early afternoon of the 23rd of November, our combat group was surprisingly reinforced by a larger pioneer engineer unit under the leadership of a Hauptmann. They suddenly appeared in front of us from nowhere, driving forward a platoon of Russians they had taken prisoner while on the way over here to us. The unit came from a pioneer school which had been stationed near Kalach on the Don Heights. They were able, with a strength of nearly 3 companies, to save themselves from the T-34s. The experienced pioneer Hauptmann takes over command of our combat group and brings some organization to the confused and demoralized men. It turns out that most of the demoralized soldiers and NCOs have no combat experience, while those in the Stalingrad area mainly served in supply, maintenance, and administrative units. Even though we, the replacement troops since October, also don't have much front-line experience, we are the best trained and armed unit, and are well prepared for any serious incident. For that reason, we have the only combat-proven men, assistant machine gunners, assigned to us. During the breakthrough, they were either sick or on their way back from leave, and were in the rear areas. I'm not particularly happy when a leader assigns me Obergefreiter Petsch, the one whose nerves have failed him, as my number two. Cooper is assigned as number two to Meinhardt, who has the second MG-34 light machine gun in our squad. Our morale is boosted by the knowledge that most of the men in our unit will be taking up positions close to each other. In the meantime, we've been able to find out where we are. We're on the so-called Don Heights Road. Behind us is a village called Rychov. This lies directly on the Don and on the railway line to Chir and Stalingrad. A few kilometres to the southeast, there's an important railway bridge which crosses the Don. We can see this bridge clearly only if we use field glasses. On the other side of the Don, there is reported to be another combat unit. Only a few kilometres west of us is Chir railway station. Chir has a fuel depot and other war supplies. Two drivers coming to us from this direction report that the Russians have already secured the area. We also learn from Meinhardt that our combat unit has formed a bridgehead in order to stop the Russians securing the important railway line which leads to Stalingrad and the two bridges which lead south over the Don. For defence, we have one 88mm AA gun, two 75mm AT guns on mounts, and one quad AA gun for use against ground targets. The Pioneers have in addition several mortars and hollow charges for anti-tank work. Three tanks and another 88mm gun are supposed to be joining us. Hopes are raised more because a rumour is going around that General Oberst Hort and his 4th Tank Army is on his way to break the siege and the encirclement. With that, our situation here will also loosen up. This news, and the slogans which follow, "Soldiers, hang on, the Führer will get you out," improve morale only for a short while. We quickly realise that we are entirely dependent upon ourselves. Our early hopes disappear like the melting snow as soon as a shell explodes. The almost daily Soviet attacks and the constant fight to stay alive drain us visibly. To these privations must be added the hunger we suffer for days on end when no food can be delivered, forcing us to search through the dirty bread bags of dead Russians lying in front of us in order to find anything edible. Occasionally they'd have more German rations on them than we'd ever been given. It's all very difficult, a time that I and the few of us who survive it will never forget. It's particularly demoralizing for us because, after the loss of our few AT weapons, no more replacements are available. What is more, contact with other combat units south of the Don is non-existent. 24th of November. At about midday, one of the machine guns on our right flank suddenly starts hammering away. Then we hear rifle fire. The firing becomes more intense, and next we see Russian infantry appearing through the haze. I am meeting the enemy face to face for the first time, and apart from an undeniable curiosity, also feel an enormous amount of nervousness and excitement. The brown, huddled figures remind me somehow of a great herd of sheep moving over a snow-covered field. As soon as the herd comes under fire from us, they hesitate for a moment, move apart from each other, and then immediately move forward again. We are firing from all positions. Only our machine gun is silent. What is the matter? I have concentrated so fiercely on the Russians that I've paid no attention to Petch. Why doesn't he shoot? His ammunition belt is in place, his machine gun is okay. Then I hear Döring call over, "What's wrong, Petch? Why don't you shoot?" Yes, for God's sake, why doesn't he shoot? Some of the enemy fall, hit by rifle fire and fire from Meinhardt's machine gun, but the mass continues undeterred towards us. I am in a turmoil and feel fear in every part of my body. Why is Petch dabbling with his hands all over the machine gun instead of pulling the trigger? The questions are screaming out within me. His entire body is shaking as if in a fever, and the barrel of his machine gun is wandering backwards and forward. He's had it. His nerves are gone, and he can't open fire. What should I do? I can't just push him away from the weapon and take his place. I still have too much respect for him, but every second is precious. Finally, it happens. A burst of fire comes from the barrel. Every third bullet is a tracer round. The stream of light passes way over the heads of the attackers, disappearing into the haze. The next burst is also poorly aimed and goes high into the clouds. By now the attackers have located our machine gun. The bullets swarm around our heads and bury themselves in the embankment behind us. Petch suddenly yells out. He holds a bleeding ear and falls into the trench. Zeidel, who has seen what has happened, looks after him. This is my chance. I immediately get behind the machine gun and fire some short, carefully aimed bursts, just as I learned how. I aim into the mass of the advancing Soviet infantry. Grommel is now beside me, helping me by feeding in the ammunition belt. My aim is good, and several of the brown-clad figures fall to the ground. The waving mass stops for a moment, but then moves ahead, bent double, step by step, right for us. My mind goes blank. I only see the advancing stream of enemy soldiers coming directly at us. I again fire straight into it. Only fear is there, fear of this dirty brown heap of destruction constantly moving closer, which wants to kill me and everyone around me. I do not even feel the burning pain on the inner surface of my right hand, which I have caught on the hot metal while changing barrels seconds after getting a jam. This is crazy. We are firing with 4 machine guns and at least 80 carbines from secure, covered positions into the advancing horde. Our machine gun bursts rip openings in their ranks. Dead and wounded are hitting the ground all the time. But more of them are coming through the haze, and we can't see them clearly. The first ones are now so close to our positions that we can readily make out the plump, bent figures with rifles and Russian Kalashnikovs. Then, suddenly, 2 of the machine guns on our right flank are silenced. Immediately the mass moves towards that flank from which they're now getting only rifle fire. Together with Meinhardt, I continue to fire into it as it moves towards the right. Their move now becomes their undoing. The heavy, hard-hitting fire of the 20mm quad anti-aircraft guns also comes as a surprise to us. Their bursts sound like low, regulated beats on a drum. We can see how the tracer rounds spew out of all 4 barrels and hit the middle of the attacking mass, tearing huge gaps in its ranks. Our 2 machine guns on the right flank start firing again. I assume that their silence was deliberate. The quad machine gun is now raking the attackers in front of us, and when it stops firing, stillness descends over the battlefield. We can hear calls and crying in Russian. I take a deep breath. The first battle with the enemy has affected me deeply, but now all my thoughts are working again. I raise my head out of the trench and peer into the field ahead. In front of us lie innumerable brown clumps on the snow. The quad's fabulous firepower still amazes me. I never imagined it would have an effect like that. The terrain in front of us is quiet, and I, in my innocence, believe that all the attackers are either dead or wounded. As I move a bit further out of my trench to get a better look, a Russian machine gun opens fire. The bullets zip around my ears. Then a second machine gun starts firing and spraying us. Shortly after this, I hear a sound that I recognize from Stalingrad, and the mortar rounds start landing all around.
"Mortars!"
someone yells, and shortly afterwards, "Döring and Markowitz are wounded! We need a medic!" Someone calls back that the medic is on his way. I later discover that Gefreiter Markowitz, who was once a driver in our Schwadron, has taken a bullet through his shoulder and has had to be evacuated. Unteroffizier Döring, however, is only slightly injured on the cheek. At his own request, he stayed where he was. Petsch has lost his right ear. We're all delighted when they bring him back to the village. The mortar fire is so intense that we dare not stretch our heads over the trenches. But then we hear the familiar plop of our own mortars. The pioneers have moved into position and are now beginning their own counterfire. Their rounds rise up and over us and are exploding somewhere in the haze where it is assumed the enemy is located. Gingerly, I raise myself out of my trench in order to watch what is going on, and I cannot believe my eyes. Many of the brown lumps, which I thought were dead or wounded, are now standing up and are moving off. Under cover of their own machine gun and mortar fire, they are retreating. Varias has also realized this, and he calls out from the neighboring hole,
"Hey! The Russians are leaving!"
Now our mortar rounds are landing right in the middle of the retreating Russians. For the quad machine gun crews, either the range is too great or they are saving their ammunition for later. It's not long before the Russians have disappeared in the fog. I have just filled my pipe with tobacco when the order to counterattack comes. We are to clear the area in front of our positions and stay on the heels of the Soviets for a while longer. Before I jump out of my hole and throw the machine gun, ready to fire, over my right shoulder, I light my pipe and take a couple of deep drags. Tobacco never tasted so good, and it feels as if I have gained new strengths. We fan out on a broad front and get only sporadic counterfire. We fire back and move slowly forward. Close behind, the quad machine gun follows on its carriage. As we get to the fallen Russians, we discover that the wounded have been taken away. For the first time, I see the dead enemy in front of me. The bodies are lying spread out over the snow, and sometimes close together, just as they fell. Wearing thick coats, they are either stretched out or bent over. Red puddles of blood are frozen on the snow. My stomach is churning, and I cannot bring myself to look at their colourless faces. Now, for the first time, when I see the lifeless bodies before me, my consciousness really grasps the meaning of death. As a young person, you tend to push these thoughts far away from you, but here there is no way to escape them. These people are our enemies, but even so, they are flesh and blood, just like us. And just as they are lying here now, so could I or some of us be lying here dead and motionless in this ice-cold snow. I glance over at Gormul, who is carrying two ammunition boxes for me. The poor chap is as white as a sheet, and his eyes are staring towards the front so as to avoid looking at the corpses. The others are doing the same. Cooper, Vilka, and I go up to a dead soldier who only has a bloody half of his head left because the other half was probably torn away by an exploding shell. Vilka turns away, just as I do, while Cooper has to summon all his strength to stop himself throwing up. For us newcomers, the first view of a dead body gives a feeling of confusion, fright, and helplessness. Unless perhaps someone is of such a robust character and is so insensitive to human feelings that he is not affected. Someone like the little black Unteroffizier von der Infanterie, who looks like a gypsy. His name is Schwarz, and I saw him 2 days ago in position on the MSR. I met up with him again here, as Gommel and I were advancing against the weak but still dangerous enemy fire, behind some flat ground rising over on our left flank. While we were here, we also stumbled across a circular-shaped earthwork. Round a center circle, dug out fairly deep in the ground, was another rim, dug down to the height of a man. Meinhardt had mentioned these features while we were still in our defensive positions. He said that while the division was advancing, they used them for their artillery and anti-aircraft guns, and we could now expect the Soviets to use them for themselves. This was obviously correct, for scattered around there were a number of dead Soviet soldiers. This is when I hear this black Unteroffizier tell a soldier to shoot a crumpled figure in the head. He himself had the muzzle of his submachine gun against the back of another soldier's head. Both shots sound muffled and unpleasant, much as if one had shot into a sack. I was shocked, and I shuddered. Is the man so full of hate that he even has to dishonour the dead? After this, he walks past me towards another fallen soldier. He kicks the body, which is lying on its side, really hard in the stomach, and mutters angrily, "This one, too, is still alive." He places his barrel directly on the forehead of the soldier and fires. The body, which I had assumed to be dead, convulses. "Why don't we take them prisoner?" I ask him angrily. The black sergeant just looks at me in disgust and growls. "Then try to get them up when they are playing dead. The swine think we won't realize they're alive and will cut us down from behind. I've seen it before." How can I answer him? I'm still not conversant with all the underhanded things that are done in warfare. But I would never shoot at any unarmed soldier, even if it was to my personal disadvantage. What I consider unworthy and terrible, the Unteroffizier only looks upon as a safety measure for our own protection. He simply says, "Him or us." Nevertheless, I can't bring myself to fire if I am not attacked, and I don't intend ever to change my mind. Gommel is also upset, and so he presses on, and I have to hurry to catch up with him. All the time I can hear these muffled shots to the head, and they really shake me to the marrow. Although this Unteroffizier may have a very logical argument, I still reckon a large part of his thinking comes from his rather sadistic nature, which such people can satisfy in time of war under the pretext of legitimacy. Meinhardt says that the Soviets commit atrocities on our soldiers and often do not take prisoners. So our side behaves in the same manner. He says this is the way of war, with its constantly increasing avalanches of hate. It begins with an attack and then combat. The two enemies fight for their lives, and it develops into grim determination and overreaction from both sides. That leads to revenge and retaliation, in accordance with the motto, "As you do unto me, so I do unto you." Oh, and heaven help the loser. I've never heard Meinhardt speak like this before, but I suppose he's right. I haven't been in the war long enough to be able to form an opinion. Our counter-attack is over as we arrive at the jumping-off point of the Soviet attack. The enemy has in the meantime withdrawn far behind these positions, so we take them over, keeping on the alert. After dark, we are given hot coffee and our rations. The vehicles take five wounded back to the village. On one of the vehicles are one dead.